Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We all know someone who heads for the internet or their doctor's office at the slightest lump, bump, or itch, convinced it's the beginning of the end. These small-time hypochondriacs have some eminent company. The writer Charlotte Bronte felt unsettled in her body. Pianist Glenn Gould was a notorious germaphobe. And Charles Darwin, when he wasn't tracking evolution, kept careful records of his debilitating dyspepsia. This hour, On Point, illness, imagination, and famous hypochondriacs. What health anxiety tells us about our minds, our bodies, and our culture. You can join the conversation. Are you surprised to learn that Darwin, Proust, and Warhol suffered from health paranoia? How about Florence Nightingale? What's your take on a connection between creativity, genius, and real or imagined sickness? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Tunbridge Wells in Kent, England, is Brian Dillon. He's the UK editor for Cabinet and Arts and Culture Quarterly. His first book, a memoir called In the Dark Room, won the 2006 Irish Book Award for nonfiction. His new work is The Hypochondriac's Nine Tormented Lives. Brian Dillon, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you with us. And so here we are looking down through your list at James Boswell, Charlotte Bronte, Charles Darwin, Florence Nightingale, Alice James, sister of Henry, and Marcel Proust, Glenn Gould, Andy Warhol, a German jurist I didn't know named Daniel Paul Schreiber. How'd you put this list of hypochondriacs together, Brian Dillon?
I guess I started really from a couple of perspectives. One of them was historical. I discovered quite early on in the research that hypochondria meant different things at different historical periods. So if you go all the way back to the 18th century, the book begins in the 18th century with James Boswell. It meant something, in a sense, kind of closer to what we would nowadays call depression.
Or a nervous breakdown.
A nervous breakdown, indeed. So and by the 19th century, it started to take on several other kinds of meanings. Nowadays, we mean something, I guess, you know, slightly insulting quite often by the term. But what I was looking for in choosing the nine lives, and it seemed at some point important that it be nine lives, was I guess, hypochondriacs, historical hypochondriacs, whose symptoms were somehow, you know, exemplary, but at the same time who had some kind of insight into their own cases. So they had left us writings, for example. They'd left us either in fiction, in poetry, but more obviously in letters and autobiographies. They'd left some hint that they knew that their illnesses were imaginary.
In other words, because these were very often quite people who wrote a lot, we know a lot about how they felt and what they were concerned about when it came to their health and their bodies.
Exactly. And of course, you know, hovering in the back of this book, which is about nine people, there is a long, long history of anonymous hypochondriacs about whose symptoms we will never know anything.
An evolution over time of what it means and how we feel about it. I've seen you remind us that, of course, many have written about hypochondria. We mentioned Molière and Kant and Edgar Allan Poe. In the 19th century, it was kind of, as you've written, strangely fashionable to be hypersensitive to body and soul, an indication of a refined aesthetic nature, you write.
Absolutely. That really starts, you know, back in the 17th century when hypochondria is thought of as primarily an organic illness. You know, it's a disease with real symptoms, and they pertain more or less to what's called the hypochondrium, which is the area of the body just below the ribs. And doctors these days, you know, modern physicians will still understand what that's meant, what's meant by that term. But so it starts off in the 17th century as a real physical illness, but it starts things, you know, qualities start to be added to it in the 18th century, which have to do with a kind of sensitivity or refinement or civilization or civility or sensibility, all these different kind of related terms. And so it does, it actually becomes fashionable. And in the early to mid 18th century, there's a book published in London by a doctor called George Cheyne, And the book's called The English Malady. And he thinks of hypochondria as being a specifically English disease. It's one of the peculiar things about the condition is that throughout history it's thought of as pertaining, you know, to particular groups of people. And quite often it's national, you know. It's so English people, supposedly, according to Chain, were more liable to worry about their health or to feel themselves to be either afraid of illness or to be convinced that they were ill because of their state of luxury, because they were well off, because they were, you know, they weren't taking as much exercise as their ancestors, they were eating rich foods and so on. So he thinks already in the 18th century there's this idea that hypochondria is a modern disease.
And at this point, you've described it at some points as almost, in some ways, if not exactly a global condition, a very widespread. When you look back to Edgar Allan Poe, in the fall of the House of Usher, he writes about Roderick Usher, this, as you say, dilapidated aristocrat, specifically calls him a hypochondriac. And you write, Usher, who seems to be allergic to the world at large, is at once a connoisseur of perplexing sensations and a precursor of today's legions of the worried well. The worried well. Are we all hypochondriacs now?
That's a very good question. There's a notion sort of abroad, I think, in popular culture these days that somehow we are now more hypochondriacal, to use the slightly awkward adjective, that we worry more nowadays than we used to. And there's some evidence, you know, that clearly we have more resources now, especially since the advent of the internet, to investigate our own diseases or to investigate our own fears of disease. But looking back through the history of the condition and these nine famous sufferers, you actually discover that idea that hypochondria is more prevalent today is also a kind of recurring theme. It seems as if we're constantly worried that we or those around us are becoming more fretful about illness.
Even in our hyper-attuneness to health, can that too be a kind of hypochondria, if you know what I mean? Desperately seeking perfect health?
I suppose one of the things that typifies hypochondria is a notion of a kind of perfectibility, you know, the idea that we won't just avoid illness, but somehow we can attain a sort of state of physical perfection through diet and exercise and, you know, resisting extremes of, you know, say, smoking or drinking and so forth, that we can attain almost a state where nothing happens to our body. You know, that's one of the kind of curious notions that I think some of the people that I write about in the book seem to have had, an idea that somehow to be healthy was to be almost kind of neutral, that nothing at all was happening in your body. And of course, that's not really true. Our bodies are always changing. They're always changing in response to internal and external circumstances. So health is not a state of, you know, of absence of anything happening to your body. Health, in a way, is a way of being comfortable with the fact that our bodies are always changing and potentially going wrong.
You quote John Donne here saying, "There is no health. Physicians say that we, at best, enjoy but a neutrality." So you've got eminent hypochondriacs here, from James Boswell to Andy Warhol, and a lot in between, nine of them, Proust and Glenn Gould and Charlotte Bronte. You've got very intimate portraits of their hypochondria one by one. Begin to take us in. Maybe Charles Darwin, it would have seemed that he had enough to do without being hypochondriac on the side. Or maybe it was central.
You would think, well, curiously enough, you know, very late in his life, Darwin never wrote very much about himself, but in the one of the very, very few autobiographical little essays that he wrote, he said that he only really ever achieved anything scientifically because he was sick. And you look back through his life, his ailments seem to have started when he was relatively young, so as an adolescent. He's already complaining that there is something wrong with his hands and his physicians can't quite work out what that might be. He has various kind of aches and pains in his hands. Before the journey on the Beagle, you know, before he set off on his first researches, he first of all had heart palpitations. He was then convinced that there was something wrong with his nose. And in fact, the captain of the ship almost didn't let him on the boat because he thought that Darwin was a rather sickly and enfeebled young man who simply wouldn't be up to the rigors of a sea voyage. So he already, you know, as a young man, has this kind of this sort of enfeeblement about him. But the really interesting point, I think, in Darwin's career is when he's actually working on The Origin of Species, and he's living not far from where I'm speaking to you right now, in Kent, near London, and he organizes his time, he organizes his work around his illnesses. So he's suffering from, still at that point, heart palpitations, he's suffering from eczema, he's suffering terribly with indigestion or dyspepsia. He keeps a diary of his various attacks of indigestion and indeed his flatulence.
Not to say flatulence, yes.
Indeed, his diary is peppered with little scrawled memos that say fits of F.
But how did he think that made his science possible? Why the fact that he was sick, quote unquote?
Because it allowed him, and he admitted this, to avoid professional responsibilities in London. So it meant that he could retreat into his family home and into this very, very rigorous daily schedule, which involved actually, when you read accounts by his family of how much time Darwin spent really working, it's extraordinary that how much he got done in something like, you know, 2 or 3 hours a day, because the rest of his time was spent trying to relax and trying to avoid these various ailments that kind of beset him. So he goes for walks in his garden, he lies on the sofa and he listens to his wife playing piano, his daughter, you know, reads him a novel, and so on and so forth. Wow. And he's able to find, in other words, within this kind of invalid routine, he's able to find this other space in which he can actually work totally, you know, uninterrupted.
So in some sense, and he's not the only one you're profiling here who said that among these very creative people, he was sheltered within his hypochondria to do other things as much as it tormented him.
No, absolutely, yeah. And there's a sense with some of the people in the book that hypochondria becomes a kind of shell inside which they can live and get things done.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about illness, imagination, and famous hypochondriacs, from Darwin to Proust to Andy Warhol. Brian Dillon is with us from Tunbridge Wells, England, author of the new book, The Hypochondriacs, 9 Tormented Lives. And he goes right down through Boswell, Bronte, Darwin, Florence Nightingale, Alice James, Daniel Paul Schreiber, German jurist Marcel Proust, Glenn Gould, Andy Warhol, with lots of asides on the world here. What about you? Are you addicted to WebMD? Is our whole country afflicted with health anxiety, worried wellness these days? Brian Dillon, here's a posting on our website from a listener, Willa, who says, Charlotte Bronte watched her mother die of cancer and all 5 of her siblings succumb to ghastly deaths from tuberculosis. None reached 40. Charlotte herself died at 39, possibly from tuberculosis, typhus, complications from pregnancy. Life expectancy at Haworth in 1850 was 24. Can anyone call Charlotte a hypochondriac, sir?
Good question. Actually, Charlotte called herself a hypochondriac.
Okay.
And what's happening really at that point, you know, in the mid-19th century is interesting. She uses the word to describe something that we would really now think of as a nervous breakdown. When she first worked as a teacher and later when she travelled to Brussels, she had what she called a fit of hypochondria, and it involved a kind of terrible melancholia, terrible sense of lassitude, a dreadful sense that she was going to be stuck in this life of kind of drudgery and duty for the rest of her life. And she, funnily enough, relates it to writing, you know, because it's a point in her life where she simply doesn't have enough time to write. So, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm not denying for a moment, you know, that Charlotte Bronte had rather a lot of real illness around her and rather a lot to be justifiably worried about. But what's interesting to me is the relationship really between that life circumstance and how she thought about her own body. And it's this word, you know, that keeps coming up in the way that she describes her predicament, is hypochondria. She doesn't mean by it at that point it's a simple fear of illness. So it's one of those stages in this kind of very, very complicated pattern of how the idea has developed.
How did she think about her body in that case? What are you pointing to there?
I think it's to do with a sense of a kind of overdeveloped sensibility. One of the things that hypochondria names, I mean, still, is this sense that the hypochondriac is oversensitive to the world and feels, both physically and emotionally, feels things that the rest of us might simply pass off and forget about, feels those things very, very keenly. And, you know, Charlotte Bronte, I think, thought of herself as kind of as terribly kind of beset by the world in that sense.
Let's get a call right here, if we may. Brian Dillon is with us. His book is The Hypochondriacs. Let's go to Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I this sort of strikes me as like the flip side of the placebo effect, where people who actually do have something wrong with them get better when they're given sugar pills.
Mm.
And if you actually believe there's something wrong with you, I've also read of like people being told by, say, a witch doctor that they were going to die in the next 24 hours, they actually did, even though there was absolutely nothing wrong with them.
So the flip side of placebo effect and maybe the mind controlling its body. Mark, we'll look at that. And let me get one more right here, if I may, from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, on the same point, or nearly. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I have another link to this episodic adventure of mankind.
Yes.
I think the mind is, in some people, the mind is different because they are able to be in a intimate contact with their body. And I think that all of this delusion is actually caused by infection. And I think over time we will find the causation.
Are you a medical professional yourself, Bob?
Yes.
And you don't think ultimately it is delusion, that people are actually feeling something going on when they appear to be hypochondriacs?
Yes, indeed. I have had many, many people that I have had experience with, and if you really get to the heart of the matter, there is something there that medicine does not have the know-with-all, which the human mind has. The human mind is much more advanced than medicine, and it will, over time, will prove out, I think, that infections, all disease, I believe, comes from infectious agents, bacteria and viruses. And this malaise that comes upon one and one tries to figure out what is wrong with their system. Something is something has gone awry in the system, and I think they then it's a preoccupying thing. And I think what he probably was faced with was that in order to get away from that malaise, you must focus. And I know at periods in my life, when I was in graduate school, I had some problems, and they thought that I had a type of neutrophil blood disorder, and come to find out I did. But the medical community just looked at it as a some sort of a preoccupation that I had without a cause.
Bob, it's fascinating, and let us pick it up. Brian Dillon, how about it? You are profiling quite exquisitely sensitive souls in your list here. What about Bob's observation as a medical researcher, saying he expects one day we'll find out that a lot of this is actually rooted in some kind of actual problem they're picking up one way or another?
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, Bob's point is a very important one, because the root cause of hypochondria or health anxiety he's absolutely right, is quite unclear at the moment. And the various theories that are advanced and have been advanced in recent years, you know, one of those is that it's on a kind of continuum with anxiety disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder and body dysmorphic disorder. But that doesn't yet tell us about, you know, the kind of root cause of it. There's another theory that hypochondriacs suffer from something that is called somatosensory amplification. Mm. In other words, you know, it's actually quite an old idea that the hypochondriac feels ordinary sensations, but they're heightened. And the root of that is absolutely unclear at the moment. I mean, there are, you know, psychoanalysis has its own theories about the kind of mechanisms that are at work. So it is. It's rooted in obscurity still at the moment, even though there are treatments that appear to work, a combination of therapy and antidepressants seems to work up to a point, but that still leaves us with a kind of mystery at the heart of the condition.
Tell us more about how hypochondria manifested itself in some of your illustrious subjects here.
Well, we've had a look at Darwin. One of my favourites, I mean, I suppose in a sense the most sympathetic character in the book for me is actually Alice James, who, as you said earlier, was the sister of Henry and William James. Mm-hmm. And Alice was, you know, she was a younger sibling, she was a woman. She grew up in this, you know, intellectual hotbed of the James family, but she never had any opportunity to fulfil what seems to me, you know, reading her diaries and letters, and an intellect that was really on a par with those of her brothers. Mm. And so she lived a life of more or less total invalidism from her late adolescence. And she was diagnosed around the age of 18 or 19. She was diagnosed with hysteria, which was a very common diagnosis in women at the time.
Are you suggesting she lived as an invalid because she was frustrated in her desire to express her intellect more?
Well, there is a sort of pattern among some of the women that I write about in the book. In fact, Florence Nightingale comes right out and says it in a short essay that she wrote called Cassandra, mm. Where she says that actually women in the mid 19th century, the only refuge they have, she says, is the sick room, because they're so caught up in a kind of social responsibility, which leaves them no time for intellectual work, if that happens to be their ambition, that the only space they have left to them is the sick room, is being sick. Mm-hmm. And Alice retired. She moved to England and lived in London for many years and wrote ceaselessly. So she's writing letters to her brothers and to numerous correspondents around the world, and she's writing a diary in which she describes herself. She's a peculiar hypochondriac, because in a sense she's the happy hypochondriac. She's extraordinarily amusing about her own enfeeblement and her illnesses. And at the age of 42, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she was told that she had merely months to live. And there is this desperately sad entry in her diary, but at the same time, strangely kind of comic in a steely sort of way, she says to her diary, to those who wait, all things come.
A kind of weird celebration there.
Exactly. It's almost as if at that moment she starts to live for the first time. I mean, that sounds like a morbid way to put it.
But what did she mean by that? She had imagined problems for so long, at last here it was? The thing itself.
She was being believed for a start, yeah. Because, you know, as Bob said, there is always the danger with a kind of diagnosis or perception of hypochondria that actually what's behind it is a real and undiagnosed illness. But she seemed to find almost a sort of destiny, you know, that her work, she talks about it in terms of work. She says, you know, this is my work, as if somehow it's kind of on a par with Henry's novels or with William James's psychological writing.
How about Proust?
Proust, you know, Proust, somebody said to me quite recently that Michael Jackson was the Proust of the 20th and 21st centuries. Mm. There's a kind of terrible cliche about Proust, which is that, you know, even if you've never read Proust, you know that he wrote in a cork-lined room, more or less in his bed for many years. Proust suffered from asthma, and the asthma and various complicating factors around it is probably what killed him. So he's a hypochondriac who is also ill. He's actually really sick. But what's interesting about him is...
What makes him a hypochondriac, then? I'm sorry.
Exactly. He uses his illness. He, in a way, performs his illness in order to find a place for himself, a retreat for himself in which he can work. So he lives out more or less the last decade of his life in bed, surrounded by his servants. And he writes long into the night, and he will wake in the afternoon and, you know, take various drugs for his various ailments. And life comes to him. You know, his social life comes to him in his bed. He occasionally makes little forays out into to hotels and restaurants in the middle of the night.
A tremendous breakfast routine, I think.
An extraordinary breakfast routine that involves, you know, one croissant, possibly followed by another, but but it's entirely down to the sort of daily whim of whether he will eat the second one. He constructs a world around him, around his illness, essentially. And although that illness was real, I think in a way what makes him, what makes it, you know, not unfair to call him a hypochondriac, is that he turns it into a lifestyle, in a way. He turns it into a performance. And that performance is what allows him then to have space to write. And one of the things that you know, clinicians will tell us and that psychologists will tell us about hypochondria is that it's never just an individual thing. It's also a kind of pattern of behaviour around the person who is sick. Because quite often...
accommodation or derision, exactly, or whatever it may be.
Exactly, exactly. Whether it's what the hypochondriac, what the person who's worrying needs from others, or actually, even possibly, what other people need from that person. You know, that in a family dynamic where perhaps the family requires that person to be ill.
And of course, there is always that ambiguity. You're right, we behave as if the boundary between sensible vigilance or precaution and pathological preoccupation or fear were perfectly clear, when it is not. there's the ambiguity where all kinds of behavior can thrive.
Well, exactly, exactly. I mean, in a sense, you know, the hypochondriac, what I'm trying to also get at there is the idea that we accuse other people of being hypochondriacs. You know,
right.
We use it as an insult. It's not something that we want to admit to in ourselves. But it's worth taking this subject seriously because hypochondria is something that the hypochondriac knows something, in a sense, that the rest of us possibly don't know or refuse to admit, which is, of course, that in the long run, there is no long run.
Yeah.
We're all doomed. And so there's a sort of truth in hypochondria. So the question the hypochondriac kind of demands that we answer is whether our attitude to our bodies is a healthy or an unhealthy one. Should we be forgetting about our bodies, or should we be constantly vigilant about our bodies? I guess that's the question that the hypochondriac makes us ask.
Brian Dillon, stand by there, if you would. Lots of callers would like to talk with you. Jackie in Swampscott, Massachusetts. Jackie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to share with you, as I was listening to the beginning of the program, that when I was a senior in college, my English thesis paper was on hypochondria and how it informed the work of all three Bronte sisters.
Oh, so you've been right there. Yeah, and what did you see?
I absolutely saw what your guest was sharing. I wrote about how Charlotte's illnesses, you know, both real and perceived, you know, completely permeated her work. And in the same vein, you know, illness is a central, it's a character almost in all three of the Bronte sisters' works. It permeates the novels as you know, in the same way that it permeated their lives. And, you know, even with Emily, you know, she willed herself to die. You know, and that is certainly a form of hypochondria in itself.
Yeah, Jackie, I'm so glad you remind us of that, and I thank you for your call. Brian Dillon, you know, you point to her, Charlotte Bronte's, some of her characters, Lucy Snow and William Crimsworth and Jane Eyre, and say, not to mention what Andy Warhol did with his work, but here are hypochondriacs, as Jackie says, writing their syndrome right into their fiction, their work.
No, absolutely. And, you know, Charlotte Bronte talks about it in three places. She talks about it in Villette, which I think of as her greatest novel, and The Professor, which she during her lifetime was considered a failure. But the one that might be best known to listeners is actually Jane Eyre. There's a moment in Jane Eyre before the wedding, before she's supposed to get married to Mr. Rochester, when she starts to express her worries about the wedding and about the entire setup. And Rochester says to her, "This is pure hypochondria, Jane. Your worries have made of you." He uses this amazing phrase. He says, "It's made you a little nervous subject."
Yes. And Andy Warhol, no less, in a very different era, also drawing his obsessions with his skin and his body and his health into his work.
Now, absolutely. You know, Warhol, as people may know, suffered terribly with his skin from a very young age. He lost his hair then, of course, when he was a very young man. And so in a way, he invented, you know, what we think of as the kind of almost comical, almost caricatured Warhol persona in order to hide away that vulnerable self.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about illness, imagination, and famous hypochondriacs. From Darwin to Proust to Andy Warhol, Brian Dillon joins us from Tunbridge Wells, England. He's author of the new book, The Hypochondriacs, 9 Tormented Lives. Brian, you're right. We will talk a little later in this hour about Howard Zinn, the people's historian who died yesterday at 87. That's sadly for real. Brian, you say, in the physician's waiting room, still unsure whether the symptoms that have lately troubled us are real or imaginary, we might well console ourselves with the knowledge of who has been there before us. And you've got Bronte and Florence Nightingale and Alice James and right on down. People often drawn to make a connection between that kind of artistry, creativity, and perhaps hypochondria or illness. You quote the philosopher, how do you say, Gilles Deleuze?
Gilles Deleuze, yes.
Share his way of thinking with us.
Oh, it's a very brief sentence from an essay by the French philosopher who says that there is a kind of cliche, you know, that that artists and writers and so on are sick, that somehow their creativity comes out of a sort of morbid personality. Mm. Deleuze says, he says, actually, they're doctors. They're a kind of doctor. And what I think he means by that is that they teach us, they examine themselves. You know, mm-hmm. They examine, they perhaps have more time and space to examine their relationships with their own bodies, and they can teach us something about how we think of our bodies, how we experience our bodies, and how we, as it were, kind of thrust ourselves into the future of our bodies and either fear or are at home with the fate, the future fate of our bodies.
Sometimes it's very radical and hard to deal with. The German jurist that you write about, Daniel Paul Schreiber, tell us his story.
Schreiber, in a way, you know, if Alice James is the most sympathetic character in the book, for me, Schreiber is by far the most tragic. Daniel Paul Schreiber was a German judge. He's most famous for an essay that Sigmund Freud wrote about him in 1911. Schreiber wrote himself a book which is called Memoirs of My Nervous Illness. And in that book, he recounts the story at the age of, I think, about 44. He was diagnosed, his first diagnosis was hypochondria. Mm. So he was starting to experience what seemed to be delusions and terrible fears about his body. And he was hospitalized. And while he was hospitalized, he wrote this diary, which then became the book. And his symptoms are extraordinary. His symptoms are bizarre. He imagined that he was being turned into a woman. He imagined that he was being turned into a woman by God, who would then impregnate him.
Kind of immaculate conception.
Exactly.
There. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Once that had happened, he, Schreiber, would then repopulate the world with the children of God. He thought that his head had been invaded by, I think it's 250 Benedictine monks. He imagined that his spine was being extracted from his body, that it was emerging from his mouth in small clouds. So on and so forth.
Is this hypochondria or insanity?
Well, this is the question. I mean, he's in the book really as a kind of really extreme example of what it's possible for a person to imagine about their bodies. Now, many people since have argued that Schreiber was clearly suffering from what we would nowadays call schizophrenia. That's, you know, it's unclear. But what's interesting to me is, first of all, that he, you know, at the time he was called hypochondriac, and secondly, that he is this amazing, this extraordinary, almost, you know, the book reads like a work of science fiction.
Yes,
it's at the very furthest extreme of what it's possible for a human being to experience or to believe about their bodies, because at various points, you know, he actually believes that his body has vanished, that there is nothing left.
Freud wrote about him, but didn't Freud come to think of all this as a hypochondria and their complaints as a kind of displacement of other psychological undealt with problems?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Freud wrote very little about hypochondria, and what he did write is quite ambiguous. He talks about it at various points in his writings as being totally obscure. You know, it's really unclear what the condition is and what its origin might be. He ends up concluding, when he writes about Schreiber, that hypochondria is a form of narcissism, and he has this marvelous kind of little aphorism that he uses to describe the disease. He says, hypochondria is the state of being in love with your own disease. So, but he never really thinks of it as a condition in itself. He always thinks of it as being related to something else. So it's related to depression. It's related to other kinds of neuroses. So it's a mystery for Freud, really.
Let's go to our callers, Will in Louisville, Georgia. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Brian.
Hi.
Hello, Will.
Quick question. You keep mentioning addiction to WebMD.
I threw that out in fairness, just as a question, because you can look anything up now.
Sure, and so the term cyberchondria pops into my mind that I've heard once or twice.
Yeah,
I'm sure Brian knows it. So, Brian,
absolutely.
Do you think that the availability of medical sites like WebMD have allowed those of us with propensity for hypochondria to have it manifest maybe when otherwise it would not?
I think, it's tricky to know, really. I mean, clearly the amount of information that's out there seems to be much greater these days. But you have to remember that if you go back, to the 18th and 19th centuries, people like James Boswell and Charlotte Bronte, these people, who were, not exactly very wealthy, but were, well enough off to own medical dictionaries, mm-hmm. to own medical texts. And so people have, at least people in a certain kind of social stratum, have always had this kind of access to medical knowledge. And of course, at a time when many people might not have had access to actual medical help, people were actually having to treat themselves based on what the reading matter they could get hold of. So I think perhaps, the sheer quantity of information is different. But perhaps the impulse and the tendency is not all that much changed. In a way, hypochondriacs maybe 50 years ago, 100 years ago, would act on the basis of what knowledge there was. And quite often that knowledge would be hearsay via, friends and family and so on.
But heaven knows you can go down that rabbit hole and just keep going with the web these days. Never mind one medical book or two. It's the whole world. Let me go to Becky in New Ellington, South Carolina. Becky, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Brian.
Hi.
Hello. Okay. I just wanted to comment that sometimes my husband accuses me of being, a cyberchondriac. And I wanted to comment that your show kind of makes me feel more normal about it, that maybe I do have a super sensitivity about the signals that my body tells me. And I'd like to know what the name of your book is, Brian.
Oh, sure. The book is called The Hypochondriacs, and it's subtitled Nine Tormented Lives.
What do you think about Becky's conclusion here, Brian? Are you intending to give comfort to those who may, feel like they could be hypochondriac or not?
Well, I think,
She's in the company of Charlotte Bronte.
Well, absolutely. It is true. One of the impulses behind the book is one of my starting points is that hypochondria is deeply disreputable, It's something that we don't want to admit to in ourselves. And we find, even with the best of intentions, we find infuriating in other people, whether they're loved ones or friends, colleagues, and so forth. It's a condition that it's very hard for other people to sympathize with. And if one of the things that perhaps the book does is to by getting inside the stories of these nine individuals, whether they happen to be, eminent malingerers, as it were, or not, getting really inside their stories and staying close to their experience, it does perhaps give us a sense that actually this is a profound experience. It's not an experience that we might want to go through, but it's a profound experience that this fear, this level of fear, that many of us, if not most of us, at some point in our lives will suffer from. So I would certainly say that one should take heart to some extent. Yes, absolutely.
Disreputable, but can be disabling as well.
Absolutely.
If people get overwhelmed where do you end up, if you're thinking about hypochondriacs or people who never give a second thought to their health until it just smacks them upside the head, where are your sympathies?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's funnily enough, some hypochondriacs are extraordinarily reckless about their health. So it may be that if you suffer from health anxiety about one or two particular symptoms or diseases, you might actually be completely reckless in all other respects, smoke and drink and so forth. So that relationship between worry and recklessness is never quite as kind of straightforward as you might imagine. I suppose one of the big questions that the book sort of raises, but doesn't come to a kind of absolutely kind of definitive answer, is this question about, you know, what would a sensible attitude to our bodies be? What would that look like? Would it be actually that we should simply ignore them until, as you say, we drop down dead? Is that a good life? Or is a good life one in which, you know, you have a kind of vigilance over yourself and you're able to live out your life for the best of, you know, for yourself and your family?
Well, we'll give the last word to John Donne today. We are all mortal, he reminds us. And as he writes, and you tell us, Brian Dillon, and can there be worse sickness than to know that we are never well, nor can be so? Brian Dillon, it's been great speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining us. The new book out soon, February 2nd in the United States, is The Hypochondriacs, 9 Tormented Lives. Mr. Dillon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
In a moment, we'll listen back to groundbreaking American historian, people's historian, Howard Zinn, dead at 87. This is On Point. Howard Zinn, the American revisionist historian, activist, and best-selling author of A People's History of the United States, died of a heart attack yesterday in Santa Monica, California. He was 87. An icon of the left, Zinn turned the standard American historical narrative on its head, elevating the voices of workers, feminists, and war protesters. He sounded that signature bottom-up note in the recent documentary, The People Speak.
Democracy is in dissent. Democracy is in resistance. Democracy doesn't come from the top, it comes from the bottom.
Democracy from the Bottom, and Howard Zinn's history as well. Joining me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author most recently of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Julian Zelizer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And many people will be, I would guess, even mourning, certainly mourning Howard Zinn's passing today. He made a huge impression on a generation and more of Americans who came to his history as a new kind of history. What set it apart, Julian?
Well, he stressed two things that many historians were starting to write about. One, as you said, was the history of America from the bottom up, really stressing how social movements from the labor movement, civil rights movement, back in the 19th century abolition, really shaped America rather than the people in Washington. And second, he gave history with a kind of left-wing twist. It was really about this ongoing struggle between these groups and then elites in Washington who were trying to stifle them.
And how did other historians look at him in doing this?
I'd say overall he was more influential, outside the academy with students, with high school students, with college students. In the end, I think what he did was to translate a lot of what a whole generation of new left historians from the 60s were writing about and popularize it. So I think it's a case of being a kind of great translator rather than the innovator of this style of history.
He taught for many years at Boston University, where we broadcast from. In 2002, we spoke with Howard Zinn here at On Point, looking back on his life's work.
Life is not worth living if you succumb to authority and lies and deception. Life is only worth living no matter how much life you have left, whether it's a year or 50 years. Life is only worth living if you feel you're working for peace, for justice, for decency.
Howard Zinn in 2002. Julian Zelizer, how do you feel as a historian hearing that? Do you hear, here's my fellow historian, or here's someone doing something else?
No, I think of him as a fellow historian. I mean, look, he was really committed to going to the public sphere and talking about the issues historians were writing about with a broader public, and I think there's an important role for that, and he did it better than I do, and certainly many of my colleagues, and I think he'll have a lasting impact. There are literally generations of students who were excited about history because of his book, and so that's a huge contribution.
He got a lot of people interested. Oliver Stone and Bruce Springsteen, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were great kind of acolytes. Here's Matt Damon on CBS talking about why he got involved in the Zinn 2009 Zinn documentary, The People Speak.
It's just an honest look at at where we've come from, and the idea that all of these changes have been struggled for by everyday people.
Matt Damon on Howard Zinn, who he admired very much. And what about the turning history on its head exercise that Howard Zinn was so big on? Had historians had it wrong before Zinn came along and really, you know, whacked Christopher Columbus around? Or was it just the way he put it, the way he presented it, that made people stand up and take notice?
Well, again, it wasn't Zinn who did it. I mean, there's literally a generation of historians from the 60s who were writing this kind of history, and he was putting it together. He was part of that generation. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just him. I mean, many historians raise that critique. We look too much up top, not enough at the rest of America. He was also criticized, though, that, you know, one of the criticisms was he didn't distinguish between different kinds of elites in Washington and Wall Street. So he didn't tell the difference between Democrats and Republicans, and some were critical of him for that. He downplayed the New Deal. He downplayed the Great Society and what people like FDR accomplished. So that's, I think, another aspect of the debate over his work.
Is there a successor generation or individual to Howard Zinn that carries that torch, Julian Zelizer, or was he one of a kind in his particular way of communicating it?
In some ways, he's one of a kind. There are other historians who are writing for the public, but he does come out of that 1960s generation, and I think kind of the new generation of historians is from a different era. They're not shaped by the 1960s. They're shaped by the 1980s and Ronald Reagan. So in that respect, it is, you know, kind of the end of an era. But I do think there'll be other historians who try to influence as broad a public as possible and will remember what he did, like him or not like what he wrote about, but at least be inspired by the kind of history, the kind of outreach he accomplished.
His People's History selling more than a million copies. Howard Zinn said, there's no such thing as a whole story. Every story is incomplete. My idea, he said, was the orthodox viewpoint has already been done 1,000 times. He died yesterday at 87 in Santa Monica, California. Julian Zelizer at Princeton, it's very good of you to be with us. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.